Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Life is Closed. I'm Cynthia Poor. My guest today is Scott Ritter. And Scott and I, we're going to talk about the second impeachment of Donald Trump and what the ramifications are. So, Scott, there's been a lot of talk on the TV that a majority of Republicans in the Senate think that a second trial is unconstitutional. So that means that there won't be 17 senators to convict Donald Trump. If there are not 17 senators, and the Democrats know this, why are they proceeding with this?
Well, I think this push for impeachment started in the aftermath of the January 6th uprising, riot, insurrection, whatever term you want to throw on what occurred when the mob stormed the U.S. Capitol. I think passions were high at that time. Many Democrats believed strongly that Donald Trump played a central role in inciting what was in effect sedition. And they believed that by moving forward with impeachment, although it was unlikely that they would be able to impeach him and have a trial prior to his leaving office, that they would be able to win over enough support among the part of the Republicans to actually gain a conviction at trial. I think I firmly believe that they thought that they would be able to make a case for conviction. But I think there was a reality check yesterday when the U.S. Senate voted down a Republican move to call the impeachment unconstitutional, noting that their belief on the part of the Republicans that the U.S. Constitution did not allow for the impeachment of a private citizen. This was defeated by the Democrats, and five Republicans voted on the side of the Democrats, but that's 12 votes shy of the 17 necessary for a conviction. And I think that pretty much tells us where the final vote's going to line up. So the Democrats have built a political trap for themselves. They are moving forward with an impeachment that is increasingly looking like less of a search for judgment in more of a pursuit of the politics of destruction to destroy Donald Trump's political viability to either run again for office in 2024 or to play a role in shaping U.S. politics in both the 2022 election and the 2024 race. So this is becoming more about, Democratic revenge than it is about a genuine search for justice.
You and I have been team political observers for a while, and there is such animosity between the two parties in Washington, D.C. Who planted the seeds to this? Because it's pretty ugly.
Well, it's very ugly. I mean, we can go all the way back to, differences between political parties and nastiness in elections. But even during the Ronald Reagan era, when Reagan's conservatism clashed with the progressive values of, say, Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House, the two sides found a way forward to reach compromise. There was a harmony between the two parties that allowed the government to function. This fell apart, I believe, starting with the Clinton era. I think the Republicans are largely to blame. Newt Gingrich's Republican Revolution came in and basically said it's our way or the highway. There's no room for compromise. And then the politics of pettiness took over with the impeachment of Bill Clinton for, a personal indiscretion, shall we say, in the White House that had nothing to do with national security and everything to do with his failings as a man. That's not an impeachable offense. But the Republicans went forward in an effort to shame to shame Clinton. And I think we saw, this continued decline with, the administration of George W. Bush, where many Democrats feel that he was a war criminal for his actions in Iraq, and feel that he should be held account for, illegally taking our country to war over a lie about weapons of mass destruction. This created a counter push to Barack Obama, whose candidacy was attacked by none other than Donald Trump and others, citing birtherism, disputing his claims to have been born in the United States. And then this really came to a head in 2016 when the candidacy of Donald Trump was dismissed by Republicans and Democrats alike as a fluke that had no chance of prevailing in the November election. And then he won, taking everybody by surprise. And this created, what was called the resistance, the never Trump, the effort to not only denigrate and undermine the president, but to remove him from office. As Jim Jordan rightly observed, 19 hours after the president's inaugural address was finished, Democrats were calling for his impeachment. I think when you take a look at this resistance movement, which was sustained for 4 years, that led to, an investigation of Russian collusion that, turned out not to have occurred. Moreover, it turned out that, the FBI and the CIA was actively colluding with the Democratic National Party to manufacture a case against Donald Trump, further alienating Trump supporters from the so-called establishment. Then we had the impeachment of Donald Trump over his phone call to the Ukraine, an impeachment that was doomed to fail from the start. It was purely a political exercise designed to undermine the president in the lead up to the 2020 presidential election. I think that when you look at that and the events of January 6th were pretty much inevitable. There is a backlash now against what the Democrats did to the Republicans, and you're seeing that in Congress today. There is resentment on the part of Republicans that the Democrats are using political processes to destroy not just Donald Trump, but the Republican Party as a whole. And I think you're going to see pushback from the Republicans, not only now, but in 2022 and in 2024. The Democrats are making a political mistake by seeking to destroy Trump and destroy the Republican Party. I think they're actually sowing the seeds of their own political, collapse in the coming years, as the Republicans will work to undermine, any policy put forward by the Biden administration. This isn't good for America. I mean, this is bad for everybody involved. This is politics taking precedent over the welfare of a nation, and it's just a sad thing to see.
Who do you think is responsible for January 6th?
Well, I mean, I think everybody is responsible for January 6th because it is a byproduct of, as I said, when Donald Trump took the stand to give his inaugural address where he, infamously spoke of this American carnage, he was doing so, in the shadows of an active open revolt against him by the FBI, by the CIA, by the Obama administration, people who conspired to manufacture a case of collusion where none existed. Trump's response was in his inauguration speech was to openly reject the establishment. He said this election wasn't about the establishment electing a president. It was about you, the people. We are returning the presidency to you, the people. And that was a big deal. A lot of the supporters of Donald Trump ate those words up, saying that, This is a battle between the establishment, the entrenched Democratic special interests, and we the people who supported Donald Trump. And this divide only became stronger as Trump's term progressed and his his administration and he personally were vociferously attacked by the Democrats for purely political reasons. I mean, I have no problem with people saying I'm opposed to Donald Trump's policies. Heck, I'm opposed to a lot of Donald Trump's policies. But this went beyond simple, you know, policy disputes. This was the politics of personal destruction, with the Democrats targeting the president and in doing so, targeting his supporters. And so when the president spoke prior to the election of the possibility of a stolen election, highlighting, you know, unsolicited mail-in ballots as the leading culprit, and then everything he predicted in terms of outcome came true. Now, that doesn't mean that the election was stolen. I'm just saying that the president painted a narrative where he said, you know, that the election would be halted, votes would come in, there would be count, they'd overturn it, and this was a coup by the Democrats. It occurred. It doesn't mean that it was really a coup by the Democrats. It's just that the perception painted by the president was bought into by his supporters, who truly believed the election to have been stolen. Indeed, today, despite all of Trump's and his allies' efforts to take this matter to the courts and the courts rejecting it, to this date, a significant percentage of Republicans believe that this was a fraudulent election, that this election was stolen. So when you combine all of this, you created a powder keg that was furthered by the president, I believe, irresponsibly addressing a crowd of highly emotional and somewhat radicalized protesters, even though he called upon them to march on the Capitol peacefully to let their voices be heard. There were elements who used this situation to push for a more violent outcome. It appears that these people coordinated well in advance of the president's speech, that the president had no knowledge of their activities, that many of them initiated the assault on the Capitol while the president was still speaking. But nonetheless, you know, it all adds up to a failure of American comedy. You know, it used to be we could get along. And what happened on January 6th is that no longer is the case. People were impassioned enough to take the law into their own hands because they lost faith and confidence in the government. And even though Joe Biden today speaks of his desire for unity, the fact remains a significant percentage of Americans have no trust and confidence in Joe Biden, view him as an illegitimate president, and the politics of personal destruction will rebound on him, just like it, you know, like it was applied to Donald Trump. These are sad days for American democracy.
Do you think that January 6th is the beginning of a new era, a new political era in the United States?
It could be. I mean, you know, the bottom line is, you know, we are, you know, American democracy, you know, is a train wreck that's already occurred. It's derailed. The cars that constitute the machinery of bipartisanship are strewn across the landscape. You know, something has to be done to right this train and get back on the tracks and get it moving. But neither the Republicans nor the Democrats are doing that. And, you know, into this vacuum of chaos, we may see, you know, additional examples of violent political frustration that we saw on January 6th. You know, something has to change in order for this to get better, or else it's going to get worse. So one way or another, January 6th, I think it will be seen by historians as the beginning of a process of sea change in the politics of the United States, either for the better, more likely for the worse.
Let's talk about the word establishment. Now, in Washington, D.C., establishment is kind of, you know, the way things are done. People who work in Washington, elected officials, they have their own set way of doing stuff. So along comes Donald Trump, who challenged the establishment. Do you believe that it's the establishment, as I just outlined, rebelling against Donald Trump?
Well, you always see pushback from what we call the establishment against any president who comes in and attempts to make radical changes. What we call the establishment is the accrual of experience and repetitive behavior over the course of decades that have produced a way of doing business that transcends politics and that can be good in some cases because it provides for continuity between political administrations, and it can be bad in that it is resistant to change. Just because the establishment does it doesn't mean that it's good, and sometimes change is necessary. And the establishment has pushed back against all presidents. But Donald Trump came in with a platform that was revolutionary in its approach toward change, changing the establishment. He was pretty much rejecting the way America had done business at home and abroad for decades. And so he got a pushback from it, but it was broad-based, broad-spectrum pushback that, took on the air of revolt. When you have, the FBI openly conspiring against a sitting president, when you have the Department of Defense conspiring with the Department of State to lie to the president about, troop rotations in Syria so that the president never got a full understanding of what the actual number of troops are, for the sole purpose of preventing the president from weighing in when the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, scheduled meetings so that the president was unavailable so that he could discuss matters outside of his earshot. This is not the way the government's supposed to work. So, yeah, there was pretty much open revolt on the part of the establishment against the presidency of Donald Trump. And now the establishment has settled down because a lifelong member of the establishment has taken over the helm at the White House. I mean, Joe Biden's, 49 years or 47 right. years, I'm sorry, as senator yeah. and vice president, make him the most establishment person pretty much ever to set foot in the White House.
In 2016, Donald Trump did not expect to win. And when he did win, do you think he was totally unprepared for what he saw as his future?
Well, first of all, I think it's disputed whether or not he didn't expect to win. That's a narrative that's pushed by, many in the Never Trump crowd that he didn't expect to win and that this came as a surprise. I think Donald Trump thought he was going to win, but he wasn't prepared for victory. This is a man who, because he's not a member of the establishment and did not attract as his inner circle of advisors people who were familiar with the politics of presidential transition. So when he won, I don't think he was prepared to become president. Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, was put in charge of transition, and he had built a team that was comprised of a lot of think tank types who were openly opposed to Donald Trump. And, Donald Trump was loath to take their advice. And so, he rejected the team that Chris Christie had put together. He tried to cobble together his own team. But the bottom line is when Donald Trump went to the White House in January of 2017, he was ill-prepared for the task of being president. And his administration was not built to seamlessly to seamlessly become part of the establishment that is needed to make Washington D.C. function. There was friction from the start, and that friction only grew as time went by?
You know, according to what I've heard on TV, a lot of the stuff that he said or done, which caused many people to disregard Trump, do you think of a lot of his words or actions he brought on by himself?
Well, there's no doubt that Donald Trump was his own worst enemy, but he's also his own best friend. I mean, what made Donald Trump attractive to so many Americans was that he wasn't a smooth member of the establishment, that he said things that no establishment member would ever say. He did things that no establishment member would ever say. Now, people who were knowledgeable about the reality of Washington, D.C. understood how self-destructive many of Trump's actions were, but you know, self-destructive from the standpoint of effective, smooth governance. But to people in the hinterlands who, aren't attuned to the finer points of, Washington, D.C. decorum, they applauded his crude, gruff, abrupt nature. They thought it was wonderful when he spoke out in a way that insulted so many people in the establishment, because that's what they felt like doing. He became an extension of them. So, again, from the standpoint of effective governance, I think Donald Trump was his own worst enemy. From the standpoint of building a very solid foundation of support amongst tens of millions of Americans, his actions were very effective.
Do you think a lot of people, even though they disliked Trump, they were rooting for a second term? Because so many people made so much money off of the books they wrote and stuff. So they considered Donald Trump a cash cow. Would you agree?
Well, I mean, I don't think he made that. I mean, the I think the better thing would be what he did to, stock portfolios. What the impact he had on big business in terms of his, tax cuts and things of that nature. He was definitely a cash cow, and there were a lot of people who supported him. But he also turned off a lot of these very same people by his unpredictability. These are people whose fortunes depend on, a sense of stability in Washington, D.C. And Donald Trump was the antithesis of stability. What I will say is this, though. Donald Trump, again, there's so many statistical anomalies about this election, one of which is that Donald Trump actually increased by a significant number the number of people who voted for him. Even Barack Obama was unable to repeat, the level of support that he got in 2008 when he ran for reelection in 2012. He won, but he had fewer people coming out to support him because, generally speaking, a president in the second term has lost the allure of a president seeking office for the first time. Donald Trump reversed this. Donald Trump brought out, more than, close to 10 million more voters. And these voters came from demographics that the media was telling us had rejected Trump. More black men voted for Donald Trump in 2020 than they did in 2016. More black women voted for Donald Trump in 2020. More Latinas voted for Donald Trump. More white women voted for Donald Trump in 2020 than voted in 2016. The only demographic that he lost in was white men. But the reality is, Donald Trump was a force to be reckoned with. It's not about millionaires making money. Keep in mind that one of the reasons that he rejected the $15 minimum wage is he said, "Why settle for 15 when I can make you jobs that make $40 an hour? Wouldn't you rather work for a real job with real wages at $40 an hour than slaving away at 15?" And the answer that many people said is yes. I would rather earn $40 an hour with a real job than, being chained down to a $15 an hour minimum wage job that has no future. So, Donald Trump, was making a lot of money for a lot of different people, not just the millionaires, not just people who write books.
Very interesting. So, Scott, our time is almost up, and I know you write for RT. So, basically, do you cover politics?
I do. I was asked early on if I wanted to cover domestic politics, and I said no. But then the Trump election cycle created a nexus between national security and domestic politics, and I started writing it. So I've expanded my resume, so to speak, and I now cover domestic politics as well as national security matters.
And you're on TV also?
Well, I'm on a lot of foreign television outlets. I do a lot of RT. I do a lot of British television. I've done some German, some Italian, some Iranian. So yeah, I get on TV, and because of the internet, that becomes available to just about everybody. So even American audiences get exposed to that.
Terrific. So, you know, Scott, we'll talk again, because I think this impeachment thing is going to be interesting. And you're telling me you think it's going to backfire on the Democrats.
Yes. Politics needs success, and this is going to be a failure. It's not going to succeed in impeaching in convicting Donald Trump, and it's not going to succeed in destroying Donald Trump politically. All it's going to do is strengthen the determination of Donald Trump's supporters to continue to resist the Democrats and Joe Biden, which again is the last thing we need if we want a successful country. People should be working to support the policies of Biden, not opposing them. But I think you're going to see a lot of opposition because of a backlash against what is deemed by many to be a politically motivated prosecution and persecution of Donald Trump by the Democrats.
Okay, great, Scott. We shall talk again. You're listening to Scott Withers. I'm Cynthia Poulos. This is All Access Closed. And if you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thanks, Scott. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day and stay safe.